Ladies of Gumption, this is episode 58, titled Alt. I am Jessica, and I'm here with...
May.
And Tatiana.
We are the Ladies of Gumption. We recap DCTV in a flash. You can contact us on Twitter at DCTVGumption. You can send us an email with your feedback, ladieswgumption@gmail.com, or you can send us an ask on Tumblr, ladieswgumption.tumblr.com. You can find our episodes on the Podomatic, ladieswgumption.podomatic.com, iTunes, or Google Play. We do have some feedback to get through with you guys. First up is Lisa. She sent an email actually last week, but she didn't get it in time for us for that episode, so we're going to do it this time. She watched The Flash 504. She thinks that Nora needing to rethink the meaning of family is going to be good for her because she's going to Papa Joe, and Papa Joe is going to define it for you. Listen and learn, little girl. So she also calls Nora the offspring of Mrs. Screw the Future, Mr. I don't give a fuck about the timeline, which I thought was funny. And she agrees that there's possibly something about her being in the past that could be either Thawne related. Feels very Thawne-y to her. She hopes that Nora's hiding her brother Thawne. She thinks that Sherlock planted the seed that he could have helped, but we don't know for sure yet. She liked that Barry took Iris aside and finally voiced his opinion on the matter of the dampening chip, and she thought those West Allen scenes were gold standard. She hopes that Jesse L. Martin has a speedy recovery for his back injury, and she is curious to see how his disappearance will affect the Cecile storyline. I don't know that it will that much. I just think that she's already started to come into like the Joe position on the show, so I don't know that it'll be too serious. She wants to know what's happening with Cisco in season 5. She's glad that Ralph is becoming bearable, but she hopes that Sue shows up soon, and that Sue will be cool with Iris. Will she ever care about Caitlin? Probably not. Shane, our friend Shane, sends us his Supergirl Legends and Arrow thoughts. He thinks that Lena Luthor, I want you to take all your feelings and shove them in those tiny boxes, and then I want you to shove them down so you forget that you have feelings in the first place. Versus Sarah, I want you to take all your feelings and put it in a box, then I want you to close the box and then lock the box. Funny. And I don't know Black Lightning also has like a put your feelings in a box theme, so I don't know what it is with Supergirl.
That's so true. Going around.
Yeah. He has a headcanon that L-Corp is the foundation of Legion's technology in the future, which is interesting. For example, the nano antibody thing that Mon-El gave that child in Argo sounds like the nanobites that cleared the air that Lena acquired from the sphere industry after Jack passed. So that could be something. He didn't really enjoy this episode too much. He felt like it wanted to be emotional, but it didn't hit too hard for him. There's too many storylines and transitions, which I agree. And the fight scenes fell flat. So all of that was kind of meh for him. But all hail the blue god, Bebo, because Bebo made an appearance in the Supergirl episode. For Legends, he thought that, it's clear that Zari's going to be the heart of the show. He loved how they brought Maisie back. And he thought it was a decent episode, but it wasn't striking, but it was still very legendy. And then for Arrow, he's confused over the 2040 flash forwards. Feels like all of the E1 kids have grown up in a screwed up world in the future. And there's like anti-metahuman laws in Central City, anti-vigilante laws in Star City. He had a lot of questions about how Felicity set up the coordinates, and so there's a lot of weird things going on in the future. Don't really make
sense. We have to go back.
Yeah. And for the postscript, he says he can tell when the content of the show has been written by a more diverse writer's room, .. which, yeah, you can definitely tell when it is versus when it isn't. The next, we have our Arrow correspondent, Tasha. She also agrees that, what if something got really wild in the Arrowverse in the 2040s, because things are completely messed up all over the Arrowverse. Legend tells us that Diggle's gone, Oliver's got one arm, and Argus is evil. Flash tells us that Barry disappeared, and Iris is miserable, and Nora is resentful. And now Arrow tells us William's been abandoned and Felicity's dead. So, good times all around. in the future. Not all you gotta do is have something like horrible happen to Supergirl on Earth 38, and then the whole miserable Arrowverse cycle will be complete. Her thoughts on the episode, she liked the Siren-Felicity interaction. She thought they were interesting. Siren using her experiences to give Felicity perspective felt like a more realistic step towards her redemption than the apology that she gave Diane in the previous episode. And she's glad that Felicity didn't end up torturing Honor, which I agree, but instead used her smarts to outthink the silencer. She thought Zoe was adorable. Can't wait to see more of the grown-up version of Canary Jr. She liked the Renee Dinah after they made up from her arresting him. But she also thought that with Diggle and Dinah, Diggle telling Dinah that family gets through 2 weeks after telling Felicity that she needed to accept that she's not getting her family back, was an interesting writing choice, but okay. She's still indifferent towards Oliver's prison storyline. It was a good performance by Steven, but Oliver is tortured every day that ends in Y, so this is really nothing new. She doesn't like Dr. Parker. If Adrian Chase couldn't do it, Roz couldn't do it, what makes Dr. Parker think that he can break Oliver? It's probably not going to happen. She predicts that Oliver is faking it until he makes it through level 2 to get to the demon. And she also thinks maybe the corruption of the prison will be how Oliver gets released eventually. She thinks that Renee's storyline with the arsonist and someone buying up property in the Glaze somehow leads to his situation in 2040 with the Glaze taking over Star City. She does not believe that Felicity is dead, you know, because Felicity is the female lead.
Not that being the female lead would have stopped her from being dead.
That's
but
true.
But in this case, she's not.
Yeah, because the whole every episode up until now is just paralleling her storyline with Oliver's, and you don't really do that and then kill her or tell us that she's going to die in episode 4 in a 22-episode season. So obviously there's more to those flash forwards that is going to be revealed sooner rather than later, hopefully. And then also, P.S., she's liking Titans. Starfire's her fave, which is good because Tasha has taste. she thinks that Anna Diop is killing it, which is accurate. Finally, we have KJ, who sent us some back of the feed.
Back of the feed.
Yeah.
I love all this feedback, by the way, guys.
Yeah.
Keep it coming, and eventually we won't even be able to fit it all in the podcast.
But we will fit it all on our Tumblr. So
exactly.
Yeah, so we can get snippets in, but the ones that we don't mention will also still be on the Tumblr, so you can also look and discuss there. But KJ mentions that, you know, some of our dislikes about the Doom Patrol episode was that it kind of halted the season. And he agrees that while that's true, he's glad that it is happening now rather than at the end of the season. Because some shows tend to do that, and it would have been much worse there. Like, once you get to the climax, you don't need, you know, filler over there. So let's get them out of the way earlier. And he also agrees that the rift between Nora and Iris will end soon on The Flash. And as someone who hasn't seen much, he says he hasn't seen a second of Arrow this season. He thinks the supposed new Archer is Roy, but they're not showing him for dramatic reasons, which I think is entirely possible.
And that would explain why he's all, you know, the bad memories, because right now there's no bad memories. So.
Interesting. We also got, so convincingly.
Yeah, you're like, yeah, sure, okay.
Okay. Anyways, we got some asks on Tumblr about the Shethority / Katie fiasco that happens over the weekend. And basically, if you don't know what that is or what happened, it was run lead up to the elections. And apparently Danielle has made this her cause. Voting is her cause to promote Aunt Shethority. So she and Katie have been doing a lot more videos around voting. And the kind of issue with that was that a lot of people brought up the fact that, well, you say that you are for women and empowerment, and yet you've been asked twice about Shethority, and you've only credited Katie as the sole creator of the brand when Katie and Candace were the co-founders of Chicorities. Mm-hmm. Why do you keep erasing it? And Katie, why don't you say anything about it? And kind of Katie responded to someone's comment. I forgot what exactly they said, but they accused, you know, Katie of not standing up for Candace, who's being erased by Danielle.
Right.
And, like, you know, Candace isn't being erased. Stop pitting women against women. And then that kind of blew up into more comments, and they wound up shutting off the comment section on that post and just kind of trying, hoping that it goes away, and it's not going away. So people wanted to know what we thought of the situation. I'll let you ladies go first.
May, do you have thoughts first that I can then piggyback off of? Or I do have thoughts.
I wrote out my thoughts.
Okay, then you go first. You wrote them out.
Yeah, I did. Because I had a lot of thoughts. Well, not like over-the-top thoughts, but anyway, not an essay. I mean, basically, I definitely think Katie could have handled the whole situation better. I think instead she was redirecting blame and ignoring fan concerns over the erasure of a black woman. And I think that what she fails to understand is that Chicority platform can have positivity in supporting women, but jumping to the defensive when listening to valid concerns, or jumping to the defensive instead of listening to valid concerns, and misconstruing that as pitting women against each other is not a good look. So it's even less of a good look when she jumps to the defense of Danielle without context, but remains silent when actual racists who were commenting about how Chicority is now becoming a safe space for white women.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, so when the racists think you're racist, you're doing something wrong. So basically, Katie made clear that her conversations with Candace about racism and listening, and just generally listening to black women and women of color, fell on deaf ears, and she needs to reassess how to be a better ally instead of a white feminist, and how to make the space a safe and nice place for black women as well as other women of color, because right now it just seems like she does tend to promote white women a lot in the stories and things like that, like her fans. And it's not, her not addressing this is just not a good look.
Yeah.
It's definitely not a good look, that's for sure. I can understand, like, let's say she didn't read those interviews, right? We're from Danielle. She doesn't know that Danielle was doing that. So that's fine. You don't have to know about that already. And when it's brought to her attention, maybe she felt attacked because she's already said that, you know, hearing about white feminism has made her feel attacked in the past or whatever. So, like, maybe she felt attacked. But then at that point, you have to know how you're going to react, right? And I feel like she had a couple of options that were superior to the option she chose. One would be just to ignore it, like you're ignoring the actual racism that is in the comments, right? Just, you don't see it, keep it moving, whatever. And then no one can say that you noticed it. Maybe you didn't read the comments. I don't know. And then the other option would be to have Danielle make a statement that includes Candace. And everyone would know that it's fake. Well, they wouldn't know it's fake, but they would assume it is fake, right? Because we already have formed our opinion. But at least we would know that Katie had talked to her and was trying to take a step to correct that situation, right? But instead, she chose the, like, support women option, which only works if you're saying that to everyone, right? Just like ignoring only works if you're ignoring everyone. It doesn't work when you're ignoring actual racism and then telling people who are calling out racism to support all women. That's the reverse of what you need to be doing. My opinion about Katie hasn't changed. I've always thought that she's someone who means well but is ignorant.
And
unfortunately, you know, I don't know, I guess I feel like, not that I think that Candace is taking a step back from Chicority or that she's actually being pushed out, but I feel like even Candace, and again, this is me projecting onto Candace, but Candace probably feels like even Chicority is not a safe space for her. And she even kind of said that in the, I don't know if you guys listened to the podcast that came out today with Katie and Candace with Variety. Well, you guys can check it out. It's called Remote Controlled with Danielle Holloway. And the episode with Katie and Candace just came out today. But even she said that she hasn't yet written an article for Chicority. She's only done the interview part. And she hasn't written the article because she still doesn't know how to put her feelings down on, you know, in a way that she doesn't fear consequences to come from. Like, she still feels like there'd be backlash from her speaking her truth that she's not ready to deal with yet. So yeah, I think that's unfortunate that she, you know, hasn't, or that she already has not become a place where she can feel safe with that, and we see reasons why, right? Or we see some of the reasons why.
Yeah, I feel like with Katie, it's she's one of those people that wants everyone to get along, kind of like the hippie, let's all kumbaya and love, and with the whole, like, pitting women against women thing, it's just, it's a very white feminist thing to say, and, you know, it does, like, when you bring up the fact that she and Candace have had discussions for Shithori before about, you know, making black women of color feel heard and accepted, and, you know, she literally asked Candace, what can I do as a white woman to be an ally? And it's like, did you not pay attention to that discussion? Because here's your chance to actually be an ally, and it's not really, you're not really stepping up to the plate. And I feel like, you know, I can believe that Katie came up with the idea, like, talking to different women, like, oh, yeah, wouldn't this be great if, you know, we could do this, or wouldn't this be great if we could do that? But if Katie built the car, she's already, Candace is the gas. Like, Candace put together the business plan. Candace did a lot of the legwork. I have no problem believing that. I feel like Katie, you know, it's not no shade whatsoever, but I don't think she has a lot of follow through. And I think that if, you know, she had a great concept.
Right. There's, like, the big picture, and then there's, like, the details.
Then there's, like, the details. So she had a great concept. And if you believe that Danielle's version of events, that season two, her, Katie Cassidy, and Katie were even talking back then about, you know, there should be a space that sat on the shelf for a whole ass year. Nothing came of that conversation until she talked to Candace. And Candace came up with, like, there's no doubt in my mind that Candace came up with, like, the business plan. Candace put it into action. I think that she did a lot of the legwork to make it a platform that's more than just, like, a Instagram page. I feel like it was just Katie, that it would just be, like, an Instagram page with maybe, like, 1,300 followers that she posted inspirational quotes on occasionally, like, when she's not busy. But, you know, by the time that, you know, Candace put in the work with, like, the business plan, went to, like, graphic designers, by the time they brought it to the rest of the girls in the season four crossover, I say season four because I'm thinking on Flash Turns, but by the time they came to, like, the wedding crossover, Shithority was pretty much built, and all the other girls had to do was say, we would like to participate and put their face on a shirt. So, I mean, Candace is basically, you know, co-founder with Katie, and the fact that she doesn't get credit for that work is, like, the whole point. And I get, like, you know, a lot of fans are, they feel like they're talking to a brick wall or whatever about, you know, why can't you say this? And it's just like, just give people credit for the work that they do. And I feel like Candace, if it was something that was being misconstrued and Katie and Danielle doing those voting videos, Candace could have said something. And the fact that she didn't say something is her saying something. So if you had any kind of questions or doubts about how she felt about it, and the next day her Instagram quote, you could take that one of two ways. Either her, you know, take her taking Tiny Buddha's advice that she's just not going to waste her energy on that, or you could take it as her subtly telling us, like, thank you, don't waste your energy on this. So you could take it, you know, either way, but, you know, it's kind of sad, like you said, that she's still doesn't feel that Shithority is a safe space where she can fully unload. And it's like, what can you do? Like, what else is she supposed to do? Because you can say, well, she could have these discussions, but clearly she has. I have no doubt, you know, just listening to her talk in interviews about Shithority and the things that matter to her, that she's had these kind of discussions before and tried, and yet these kind of things persist. So what are you supposed to do other than, you know, the Tiny Buddha quote of not wasting your energy on people that won't be receptive to it. So
right.
Yeah. I mean, I think what frustrates me the most, too, is that, like Tati, you were saying, you know, she could have answered it differently. And she could have, because this is on, it's not like she was, someone was asking this to her face, you know. So Katie could have just sat back, taken some time, or maybe done a little research. Google is right there for you. And then come back with, like, a proper response. But I she doesn't seem the type to want to do that. So,
or even like you messed up, and then the next day they tried to like, you know, just smooth it over, ignore it, pretend like it didn't happen, is still the wrong, you know, option. Just say that you messed up, or just like you said, like put out a statement making it clear, even if it's not from Danielle, because Danielle really doesn't matter. At this point, it's about Katie making it clear once again that she and Candace are the co-founders. But it just, you know, stuff is being said and Katie not correcting it is, I think, the bigger issue, because Danielle's not going to, I wouldn't put it on Danielle to change, but I would say that Katie, if people are saying things that are incorrect and you are a co-founder of this business, then I think it's up to you to put out the correction that this is the truth kind of thing.
Yep.
And she's not doing that, so.
Sad times.
Yeah. Alas.
But I think as a fan, you know, all we have to do is, and if Candace is your fave, then support Candace. Like she said, don't feel like you have to, like, waste your energy or you know, go to war or anything. As long as you're there for her and supporting what she stands for and the things she's doing. Like, some people are, like, with the icing with Candace Patton, all that kind of stuff. Just keep trying to find ways to be positive, I guess.
Yeah.
And read all the books she recommends.
Right? Productive change.
Yeah.
Even if you're mad about it.
Yeah.
Make positive change, even if you're not positive yourself.
Yeah, I think somebody replied to one of my tweets saying they were going to write like a well-worded, you know, letter to and send it to She Authority, or like even an article about intersectional feminism.
Yeah.
You know, things like that.
Okay, we're going to move it into news. The first promo image of Lois and Clark for the Elseworlds crossover was released. It's okay. I don't know what else to say about it. DC Universe's upcoming series Swamp Thing has cast its lead. Will Patton from Falling Skies is Avery Sunderland. That's the lead, right?
The lead is Alex Holland / the Swamp Thing himself.
Yeah.
He's being played by Andy Bean, is playing the human version, and Derek Mears is playing the Swamp Thing itself. And Derek Mears was, in fact, Dwarf Star from The Flash.
Oh.
Yeah.
So we have Andy Bean / Derek Mears playing Alec Holland / Swamp Thing, and then Will Patton from Falling Skies is Avery Sunderland. And Avery is described as a prominent businessman who wants to harness the power of the swamp for profit. Yeah, so Swamp Thing news, still moving forward. Going into the actual episode today, we are missing The Flash and Black Lightning, so we only have 4 shows to cover this week. Side A is the Supergirl and Arrow, and then Legends and Titans on side B. We will recap the show, discuss what we liked and didn't like, and then crown the Lady Witchin of the week. So, our host this week is Tati, and she's going to take us starting on side A, Tears of Logic / Confession.
This Supergirl episode was called Ahimsa, and the recap is as follows. When Supergirl needs help, Alex asks Lena and Brainiac to team up. Meanwhile, John questions his decision to quit the DEO until he runs into Magister Black and realizes there are a lot of ways to help his fellow aliens during this tumultuous time. It was directed by Armin V. Kevorkian, and the story was written by Eric Carrasco with teleplay by Katie Rose Rogers and Jess Cardos. So, ladies, what did we like about this lovely episode?
Well, I like that Brainy continues to be a shining star in such a heavy season. We got, like, Caradoc breadcrumbs this episode, which is awesome. Like, he's so worried about Kara and hoping that she's in her mind palace with Streaky, relaxing and okay, and I thought that was really cute. And I also like that he and Lena teamed up this episode because they are like the two smartest people on Earth, and they haven't really had much interaction together until now. Even like last season, it was just kind of, they were just kind of around each other circling like the orbit. They didn't really have many conversations outside of, oh, you can fly this 31st century ship. That's cool. So I like that they actually got to work together. And then they bonded and shared their frustration of helplessness, both being kind of like the good beans in a bad family. And like Lena's frustrated that her inventions are keep being used for evil means, and Brainy feels like out of place in the century and not being able to, you know, kind of be the full version of Brainy of himself. So it was really nice to see them bond, and like the tears of logic just broke me. Like Brainy getting like so emotional, and I mean, I'm not sure how Lena's advice of, you know, the conceal don't feel thing is works, because like, you know, you mentioned earlier, like DCTV has a thing about stuffing feelings into boxes, and those boxes are that normally I don't think that's like great advice. I don't think that's the advice that many like psychologists and psychiatrists suggest that you take, but you know, at least it led to the idea of using the nanites to help clean the air, so that was good that something came out of that. And then speaking of nanites, other reasons to love Brainy. I thought it was really cute how concerned he was. He's like, the nanites are so nervous. They haven't eaten kryptonite before. They're just nanites. I thought it was cute how like concerned he was for them. So Brainy is just overall just like the best ever. Other parts of the episode, I like Manchester Black and John's team up. I thought it was okay. It was a decent introduction to the character. And I like that he was brought in through his connection to Fiona, but that leads to my biggest dislike, so I'll just stop right there. and say that I like there's a struggle with John over whether choosing pacifism was the right choice. Because, I mean, like, you know, he chose to be nonviolent, and then all of a sudden, very violent, very racist people showed up, and it's like, well, was this the right choice to be nonviolent right now? But, I mean, like, it's not something that you can be like procrastinate on. It's like, I'll be nonviolent tomorrow. I'll just be violent today. I'll be nonviolent tomorrow. So, I mean, it's a good struggle for him to have on, you know, what pacifism actually means for him. And I also like how it's parallel with Alex and her struggle being the new DEO chief. And that's not something that comes easy to her either. So both of them are struggling with something that they thought would be, you know, natural, and it's not as natural as they thought it would be. And I like that it's a good struggle for Alex to have as well, trying to find the balance between bureaucracy and actually, you know, doing what she needs to do. And then lastly, like, an Anon just kind of blew my mind by picking up on the fact that Nia's naps are her actually dreaming and having premonitions. So, I picked up on that with James, because obviously, like, she had a nap, and then she went to James, like, I don't know what's going to go on, but I have a bad feeling that you need to not be Guardian again. But then, like, from the Anon's ass, I'm like, oh, wait, that could be why she wound up at the pizzeria, because she had a nap, and you don't really go to a pizza place for coffee, so why was she there? Maybe it's because some kind of feeling was, like, drifting her in that direction or leading her there. So, like, recognizing that now, I feel like it's just really subtle with the writers are putting that in there. And I really like that subtlety and how they're introducing her powers into the plot. It's, yeah, it's like a little cool little Easter egg. So I like that a lot.
Protect Brainy at all costs. I love that he's getting all these great scenes with characters like Alex, Nia, and now Lena. He's slowly kind of joining the inner circle and cementing himself as an emotional core character, and I like that a lot. His Tears of Logic was a great moment because it was both, it served as a little bit of comedy, and it was also really sad, and I think Jesse Rath really pulled that off. I like that he and Lena worked together and that he was concerned for the nanites as well, because that was really cute. And I generally like Manchester Black's introduction. He comes off as, you know, cool, he's a little bit suave, and he knows what he's doing when he's asking questions, and he's really unbothered by a lot of things. And it was nice to see him and John working together, and I think he'll make a decent addition to the cast. And like Jess, though, the rest of his introduction and story will go into the dislike section. I did like to see that Alex is struggling with being the director of the DEO and that she's facing challenges under all the stress. I think that maybe many people did expect her to just fall into it really easily, but I like to see that it's not so smooth for her, just like everybody else, you know, struggles at their jobs. And I think it was understandable that she wants so much to do, that she wants so much to do right, but feels like she's doing everything wrong when agents are betraying her, and the DEO right under her nose. And it's also personal for her. And I think Kyler really showcased Alex's vulnerabilities. I also like that Jean was facing doubts about his own life choices and like the line about how it's hard to reconcile who you are with who you want to be. I think that was really powerful. And finally, I of course love that they both lean on each other and when they're facing these doubts and draw strength from one another.
Aww. Y'all have said all the things, but I will just repeat them. I really enjoyed, enjoyed is not the right word, but I was touched by Brainy's worry over Kara, and like Jess said, I liked that he remembered her mind palace, remember her cat, etc. So he was really lovely the whole episode. I like that we constantly see, like, how human he is, even though there's that synthetic side of him. Like, when he was, like, going, like, I'm not a robot, and then he, like, kept shifting from one argument to the next about, like, why, justifying his feelings at that moment.
Yeah.
My heart broke for him, but I'm also was like, that's so robotic of you. Like, he's so human, but also so robotic. Like, what is the most logical explanation? So anyway.
Here's logic.
Here's logic. I love that. And Lena's advice is obviously bad advice. Don't follow it. But it really is a good exploration of who she is and why she is the way she is, you know? And also kind of like, you know, lets us know that there's going to be an explosion from her sometime soon. So I like that too. I really like the plotline of John feeling conflicted about his vow of nonviolence now that it's hurting, you know, his loved ones. And the fact that he was able to lean on Alex while he was in distress and then she did the same right back while she was feeling her insecurities. And I like how they had sort of like the back and forth interplay of like affirmations, right? She's like, you're the soul of wisdom. And he's like, the best decision I ever made was leaving the DEO to you. And I'm just like, oh, babies. I love a father-daughter duo. So, yeah, like y'all said, I love the parallel in their journeys this episode and how they both, like, you know, we sort of get to see how they're both balancing out, like Alex managed to keep her cool in front of her employees, right? And put on a brave face, even if she was kind of losing her shit in front of Kara. but they worked that out. At the same time, John is, you know, over here having his existential crisis, but then he's able to be the voice of reason to Natchester Black. So I enjoy everything about them. And that scene, the affirmation scene, was my favorite of the episode. So, but yeah, speaking of Natchester Black, he is super hot. He is super charming. I can't wait to see more of him. Even though I did not like the plot device that they chose to introduce him. We'll talk about that later. But I did like his gruff and gruffer dynamic with John and how quickly they sort of, like, jumped into action and, like, worked so well together. We didn't have to, like, once they established, like, who they were and what they could do, we didn't have to continue the whole, like, I don't like you. I don't like you either. Let's fight about this, you know, nonsense that sometimes shows do for humor. So I'm glad they did not do that. I also liked the scene where he was, like, commiserating with the racist in order to get information from him. And I was like, yeah! And also, the way he said soccer in an American accent, in a mock American accent, was my favorite thing about him. So, yay. I love Nia, as always. I like that she was looking out for James, that she tried to stop him from making a dumbass mistake, even though she failed. But she tried. She did her best. He still did it. That's okay. And speaking of which, the villains actually made a good choice, made a good decision, a tactical choice, trying to strike fear into the hearts of humans by mind-controlling aliens to act like villains. And I was like, hey, that could have worked out for you. So, you go, guys. All right, what did we not like? What just chapped our asses? What? I don't know.
It really chapped my
There's some kind of phrase like this. Alright, go.
Grinded my gears. It really ground my gears.
Yes!
Like, why did I have to see, and this is like multiple times over several episodes, Fiona being stabbed in the chest for the writers to be like, JK, she's totally alive, to be like, then, JK, JK, we're actually gonna kill her again. Like, why? Why did this have to happen? I feel like the writers in the premiere just, like, killed her for dramatic effect. And they're like, yeah, bad guys killing aliens. And then afterwards, they're like, know, it's time to introduce Manchester Black. I'm like, shit, wait, how do we tie him into the story? Oh, yeah, let's bring back Fiona and not get it at all. And then once he's here, let's kill her again. So, like, that, the whole thing, the Fiona situation is just really upsetting and stupid because they fridged a woman. First of all, they fridged a woman for man pain. Second of all, they did it twice because she's been fridged twice for two different men having two different angsty storylines. So, like, once, the first time she was killed, it was to give John something to angst over and something to do so he could, like, find and avenge her. And now that she's back, then just introduce her fiancé, and then, well, he's here, so now I can die again, I guess. And so now he's, like, Manchester's man pain is to, like, avenge Fiona, and so it's just, yeah, I don't like it. Like, why?
And then
they didn't even explain. Like, she had a fucking stake come up through her chest and through her neck, but she's fine, somehow. I don't know. It's just, like, bad writing. It doesn't really make any sense. Like, Fiona deserved better, definitely. And, you know, also, like, while I hated both of the Grave twins, I don't like they were died this early in the season. Or, more specifically, I don't like that Mercy died, because, you know, Otis was, like, a waste of space, to be honest. But, like, Mercy had strong connections to both Lena and Lex. They had a whole episode of her and Lena going back and forth. I think there's just, she's clearly the smarter of the two. And I feel like she had a better dynamic with Agent Liberty, so I feel like there's just more to the story that could have been pulled from all of those dynamics. And her dynamic with Agent Liberty brings me to another point. Like, it's not really clear. I mean, it's clear now who's the big bad or who the leader of Team Evil is, but, like, all this, like, flip-flopping between is it the Graves or is it Agent Liberty? Like, it feels like that's another thing that the writers didn't get clear on, which way that they wanted to go or how they wanted to let the story develop. Because in the premiere, you have, like, Mercy at the forefront, and then they imply that Agent Liberty is a real leader, and then they show us his background story, and they show us that Mercy actually recruited him. So, like, who is leading who? There's just no consistency in it, and it almost feels like they killed off Mercy just so they wouldn't have to deal with it anymore and decide who the leader is, because now Agent Liberty is, like, the de facto leader. And again, it's lazy, and I feel like they didn't think that all the way through. So, you know, by far, Fiona dying is dying and being reborn and then dying again. It's just, like, the worst part of the episode, but also, you know, I think it was a mistake to kill off Mercy, unless she's gonna magically, like, reappear somewhere down the line too, which then again, you're still stupid, so.
He could use alien stuff to bring her back somehow, who knows?
Does he even want to, though?
And would she want that? Like, if she could be brought back by alien tech, would she be like...
Yeah, she'd be pissed off. She'd be like, just let me die.
She has, like, real racists that don't want to be, like, operated on by black doctors because there's a black doctor. So I feel like Mercy would be the same.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty awful. Anyway, I obviously agree with a lot of what you said. I also really hated that fact that Fiona died again. Like, she suffered a Foudy situation here and that the writers didn't know what to do with her. So they made her and us suffer by stabbing her, then finally killing her off for good when it seemed like she'd already died. And I don't appreciate that it was all to give Manchester Black a story of revenge and purpose. Like, helping aliens out wasn't enough of a purpose to join the fight already. You had to kill Fiona too. It just looks bad. It doesn't even seem like it was well thought out, like Jess said. And no one needs more women being fridged for man pain on these shows because it's become so exhausting. And they haven't learned from past mistakes and they keep doing it. So that's frustrating. And I also didn't like that the Graves siblings died only 4 episodes in and they go out without much fanfare. It also looks bad because they did set it up that Mercy recruited Agent Liberty. And now it just looks like they killed her because they didn't want a woman leading the movement, which is a major fail, as I think a white woman in power beside Agent Liberty would have made a bigger statement to parallel our real world, since they are really aiming to do that. I also dislike Kara speaking while she was in the suit. It was so obvious that Melissa wasn't on set, but since they had to give her lines, she could have just spoken without having to show her face. It didn't fit with the rest of the episode, and it was kind of painful to watch. And I also didn't think it was smart for Carr to obviously go out into the field when she was obviously still recovering. And I would have understood if she had just to sit this one out. And so the episode, because the episode already had a lot going for it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I'll start small and I'll say everyone that Kara knows, except for Kara, standing in the same room.
Oh, wait, James is there. Was James,
James
there?
Is right there next, James is right there next to her. Yeah. Okay. Worrying about Supergirl, and Lena still does not get informed that Kara and Supergirl are the same person. And yet at this point, she's so, like, whatever, that she's not even asking, like, hey, where's Kara? Like, Kara was dating Supergirl's partner in superheroing last season, so it's not like Kara does not know Supergirl, and yet Lena has never seen Kara and Supergirl in the same place? Okay, so it's just so stupid at this point that I just have to get through it only by pretending that Lena knows. Like, I just don't think about it. Lena already knows.
I will bring up, like, and Anand asked us about the suit, because apparently in the suit, you just said, like, when Kara's talking to Alex, that Alex is jealous of Kara's superhuman abilities or whatever. Like, the suit was, like, reading Alex's body language, and Anand was like, how does the suit know who Kara is? And Lena doesn't know who Kara is.
I'm tired. So anyway, I gotta put that in every week until they rectify this. It will be a complaint, I am sure. Okay, now I'm gonna second the point about Kara being shown in the suit. Like, when you only heard her and you see Alex talking to Sue, like, you feel that sense of desperation and claustrophobia, and it's, like, believable, right? And I was like, oh man, that must suck for Kara in there. And then they show Kara in there, and it just looks like B-roll footage from Iron Man, the first movie. And I was like, okay, this is just stupid. Like, I don't know. I just, at that point, it's, like, clear that Melissa was not there, and that they had to slice together, and it took me out of the moment. So I was, like, laughing in moments that should have been serious. All right. Again, I agree. Like, Supergirl's injury and then, like, the whole little, like, I might die in the atmosphere or whatever, like, only worked as, like, a tool in Alex's storyline, and just so the president could have, like, a reason to be angry at her. Because it didn't really, like, I feel like Supergirl could have stayed inside just fine in that first fight, for sure. And then the second fight, they said they wouldn't win without her, but, like, I don't see why not, especially when that rando dude just shot them and they died, like, nothing anyway. And then it was like, oh, end of mass hysteria. So, whatever. I didn't feel like Kara was really a character in this episode. I just felt like she was, like, a tool for everyone else's storylines. Like, this was definitely the episode where they did not have Melissa at all. So, anyway. I already said I loved what Nia did, and I liked that Anand and Jessica's theory / evidence piecing together that she's taking her naps, and then she's waking up and having, you know, with the visions in mind. But I felt like we didn't get much of James at all to, like, know why he got to that place. Like, again, it was sort of just like, he was there so that Nia could warn him, and then he could still do it anyway. Like, I don't know. I was like, not even, like, a scene of him, like, being like, oh, man, I wish I could go out there, but, sad times. So, I was like, oh, okay, I guess. I only knew that James was thinking about it because Nia came up and was like, I know, I'm not saying you're thinking about it, but don't do it. Like, oh, okay. So then I'm like, what if Nia made it happen? You know, like, the, like, edible, right? Like, you have the future, so you try to prevent it, and then it happens? I don't know. But it was just, like, it was too subtle for me. Okay. And then the big one, of course. The big problem is, why the fuck would you revive Fiona just to kill her again? What was the point? Why are you putting me and Manchester through this again? Like, can't he just have a vendetta because Fiona was captured and hurt without her needing to die? And then, like, even better, you would have a living Fiona who's like, don't be violent, Magister Ahimsa! And then he'd be like, but I have to because blah, blah, blah. And then, like, the relationship deteriorates while he's still doing his thingy and she's trying to hold him to the better, higher values. But no, instead she's just dead. And she made him promise that he would not be violent and he would not get angry. And he was like, I promise, baby girl. And now he's, you know, it's even worse. So, I hate everything about this. Women refrigerators, obviously. The women of color, the track record that Supergirl has of them has not improved yet. We are still waiting for that improvement. And there's the fact that the name of the episode was literally Ahimsa. It was supposed to be, you know, in reference to her philosophy of nonviolence. and then they just exert the most violence on her throughout the episode, and then kill her. Like, I guess that's irony, but it's just a slap in the face. And I hated it. Also hated the deaths of Mercy Notice. They didn't make any sense. What was the point of them? Why did we have them begin with? Why couldn't it have just been Agent Livery himself coming up with this racist, genocidal mania idea? I don't know. Is it just, it was literally like, we used them for, like, their money and connections, right?
Yeah.
And now he's inherited all of that, I guess. Which would have actually been a cool story if we had seen how he disagreed with their methods, and then he engineered a situation in which they would be offed and he would be left with their stuff, you know?
Oh, yeah.
That would have been really great. Great, you know, in the sense of, like, making a murderer. But, but instead it was just like, okay, thank you for nothing. Like, Lena, will she even care that this woman that supposedly, like, sort of was a big sister to her is dead? Will she even know? I don't know. So, yeah. I didn't like that. Okay, what do we predict?
Well, going back to Nia, like, I think we had, the Anon about the dreams and the visions, someone, like, commented that they think that she knows what she's doing, and that it's intentional, but I don't think that she knows what she's doing. I don't think, like, she's not aware that her naps aren't because she's overworked and tired, that they are just,
right.
Like, she doesn't know that what her naps are. She just has, like, these strong feelings, conscious or unconscious, that are, like, guiding her. So, you know, she has a nap, and then she's like, man, I need coffee. Let me stop in this pizza place for some reason that I don't understand, but I'm going to go in here. And, you know, like, she doesn't realize the connections at the moment. I feel like the incident with James is a little bit more specific, so I'll be curious to see if she starts to pick up on that pattern in later episodes, and then maybe try to, like, force a nap to see if something happens. Because I think that would be, like, a really cool way to kind of, you know, develop that storyline a little bit further. And then I also think, like, Manchester is obviously not going to be Ahimsa, and he's going to be very violent and on his revenge streak. So I think that he and Kara will get along initially. But I guess, like, I'm just kind of suspicious because of his more villainous backstory from the comics, how if he'll be, I think he's going to be, like, more of an anti-hero. Maybe he's going to be, like, a little bit more pro-violent than Kara initially, like, wants, you know, and maybe, like, not just these specific humans, but all humans or something. I don't know. But I feel like there will be a point where Kara and Manchester's motives diverge, and he'll become more of a hindrance to the peace movement than an ally. Oh, and also that black man that we saw with President Baker is Colonel Haley, and since President Baker is an asshole that doesn't trust Alex, he's going to send Colonel Haley down to, quote-unquote, handle Alex. Those are my predictions.
Oh, I like it. I like it. For me, it's somewhat more minor, I guess, since Agent Liberty's movement is making Guardian out to be fighting, looking like he's fighting the aliens and on their side. I suspect they'll do the same thing when they realize other Kara exists and will use her to paint Supergirl as evil.
Oh, yeah.
Don't have anything, but I agree with everything that y'all said. I do think that, I agree with, like, parts of both of yours, right? So I definitely think that the other Kara will be connected through Agent Liberty in some way. And I think that Manchester Black is eventually going to turn to violence and break my heart and Fiona's too. But at least Vicky is back in, you know, the bad place. Where she belongs.
That's kind of sad now to know that, you know, Vicky's in a bad place.
But she likes it there. It's fine.
The Supergirl version of her does not deserve the bad place.
That's true. The Supergirl version of her does not. Okay. The Supergirl version of her is definitely in the actual good place.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Moving on. We've got Arrow. So, Arrow recap. Episode was called Level 2. Oliver and Felicity both make drastic moves in their separate quests to find Diaz. Meanwhile, when arsonists target Renee's community center, injuring Zoe in the process, the mysterious new Green Arrow swoops in to help save the day. Faced with pressure from the mayor to capture the vigilante, Dinah must decide if following the rules at all costs is the best plan to keep the city safe. Ben Bray directed the episode, written by Emilio Ortega Aldrich and Tonya Kong. So, feelings, questions, concerns, mostly about a positive feelings, questions, and concerns at first.
I mean, I'm shocked with myself, but I thought the team up between E2, Laurel, and Felicity was really good because I wasn't expecting it to be. And it's a strange place to be when Laurel is the one trying to convince Felicity not to kill anyone. How the tables have turned. Quentin is so powerful. I think Laurel I think Laurel had some sound advice for Felicity. And I like that even though it was her last resort, Felicity felt that she could trust Laurel and use her new lawyering skills as well as her evil skills and give her advice. So she relied on her more than I thought she would. And it's great to finally see the women on the show really interacting with each other, because I feel like it's been too long. And Felicity being smart and putting a tracker in Silencer instead was a good move, because I didn't want to see the whole episode having her be tortured. And for the most part, I really like the dynamic between Dinah and Renee. I think they have a good friendship and aren't afraid to call each other out when they think the other is wrong, and also have a close enough relationship that it could turn into something more down the line. So this could be the case now that Dinah and Zoe are growing closer in the present, and the future Zoe is fighting by Dinah's side, which I really like that reveal. And speaking of which, I did like the flash forward scenes in this episode. I'm glad they didn't spend too much time on Lian Yu. Bringing them back to Star City, I think, makes things more interesting. So I still have no idea where they're going, but it's the first time the scenes have piqued my interest. So that's good. And I spelled that one wrong. Finally, I like that they're finally showing the Glades and the impact that the rest of Star City has on them. So the meeting to discuss law enforcement and aid to that part of town was good, even though I don't like that they're essentially setting it all up to make it look bad later.
Yeah, like, I agree with you about everything. Surprise. I did think that, you know, Felicity and Laurel did make a good team up this episode. Like, I like their dynamic and Felicity going to Laurel's office and getting in by saying that they were sorority sisters, and kind of like using her wits to kind of talk Laurel into teaming up. And I liked that in the sense that it was good for Laurel. It showed like Laurel's growth. You know, because like Renee is the moral center. And he was the one that was holding Felicity back, but now that he's gone for plot reasons in this episode, I was initially, like, worried when she first suggested Laurel, because she knows Laurel's violent, and I'm thinking she was hoping that Laurel would be, like, extra violent. But I do like that, you know, instead Laurel was the moral stand-in for Renee, and she was like, you know, when Black Siren is, like, the moral compass in your group, maybe you should, like, reevaluate what you're doing. I like that it kind of shows that Laurel's redemption and her transformation into like a more she's still gray, but she's a little lighter color gray than she was initially. And I feel like that is Quentin's impact. and I like
yes.
that she's getting into this like new space. And then on the Felicity side, I'm glad that she actually did, you know, find a way to use her smarts and strategically let Honor go with like the tracker, because that's what I wanted her to do from jump, and I was getting like increasingly frustrated in the episode when I thought that she was not going to do that. So I'm glad that she did. I was like, thank God you have not lost your mind. So, you know, that's good to know, because, you know, I told y'all last week that I did not like the way that I thought it was going, so I'm glad that they kind of turned it around at the end. Surprise of surprises, again, I actually like the flash forwards this week.
Oh! Ooh!
Yeah, and I think it's like what May said, that they're actually somewhere interesting now, because they're in Star City.
I hate that damn island!
I don't know why Felicity is leading William on a wild goose chase. It kind of feels like he's on like a fantasy quest or something, and he's like gathering like objects and characters, new characters to get in his party to find the whatever. So like first there's Roy, now this episode we get Dinah and Zoe, and I love seeing, you know, how the future has affected Dinah, and then the fact that older Zoe now is like baby canary and that they're working together, it's just like really, really cool. And now all we need is JJ, so JJ can show up. And I don't know, because like in Legends he's Connor Hawk, So I don't know if they will, and that was only because Guggenheim is an idiot. So I don't know if that will carry through and they'll remember that's JJ's adult form in Arrow, or if he'll show up at all, or if he'll even, you know, or if he'll be someone different. But I do hope that he does show up, and so we can get this, like, Team Arrow Kids apocalypse thing going on. But he's the only one that's missing now. So I think that in the present, Renee and the Mystery Arrow have, like, a really good dynamic. They really feel like a duo. And so there's something about that that will go into my dislikes about how that plot is going, but I do like their dynamic. I just feel like if anyone should know who is Mystery Arrow first, I think it should be Renee. Because, you know, he's the one that's believed in the Mystery Arrow and worked with them since day one. I agree with you that I like a lot of the Renee Dinah scenes, mostly after she let him out of jail. Like, once she, like, got her head out of her ass and, like, actually released him from jail and they started working together, I'm like, yes, this is the Renee Dinah that I like to see. And, you know, she continues to be... I think they keep, of the new Team Arrow, she and Renee are getting closer, and I like that Dinah gave Zoe the canary pin, and how that parallels with Zoe being canary in the future. Like, just let Danae happen already. Like,
Danae.
It's Danae. It looks like Dine when you write it out, but it's Danae.
It did look like Dine. I was like, but that's right. His name is Renee, not Ryan.
It's not going to be Rhyna.
I like Danae better. Rhyna sounds a little weird. So Danae. And then with, like, Parker and Oliver, those scenes kind of dragged because I don't really know what his purpose is and why he wants to re-examine all of Oliver's past or why he knows so much about it in the first place. But the one scene of Oliver's storyline that came out of that that I did like was the Raph scene where Parker had Oliver put himself in his bad situation and ask what he would do if it was him and William. Because it just kind of reinforces how much Oliver loves his son, at least right now, because it's clear that he wants to do anything to protect William. And it also shows that maybe he does feel some kind of way about the burden that his shit father placed on him all those years ago that led him down the path of being Green Arrow. So it's like a tiny nugget. I don't know that it's actually a real nugget because I don't really believe that Oliver is actually taking this therapy into consideration. Maybe with, like, the thing with William, but I don't know. But it was interesting nonetheless. And then I didn't even notice, I guess, according to Tasha Diggle's in the episode, but I didn't notice him, and I didn't think he was at all.
He talked to Dinah in that one scene.
Yeah, he talked to Dinah. Yeah, he talked to Dinah. Yeah.
That totally went over my head.
Oh. All right. So, on a technical level, I really love that transition from a smiling Felicity in the photograph to the frowning, hardened Felicity in real life. And I bring that up just because I think that this show, like, Arrow has elevated itself on a, like, cinematographic level, if you will, this season. I just remember, there was that one, I think it was in the beginning of season 6, and someone posted it, and they're like, this looks like a student film, right? Yeah. So, and it did, and now I don't think that that's really the case so much anymore. Like, I think they've sharpened up their whatever skills, if you will. Okay. That's that on that. But I like, you know, like, that we're seeing just how the events have transformed her, right? Have hardened her. And it's nice that we get Renee's point of view, where he's trying to reason with Felicity over the torture issue, and he's drawing on his own experiences, which, instead of hardening him, have made him more empathetic, right? So it's interesting to see that, to see the difference between them. And I love Renee, first apologizing to Dinah for being late to the town hall meeting, and it felt like they felt like mom and dad to me, too. Even though he was calling her Aunt Dinah, but, you know, that's like a Ted and Robin situation, like, hey, can I marry Aunt Robin? You know, eventually that will work out for them. I know I was all over the, like, non-existent impossible ship of Dinah and Diggle last year, but this year it is Dinah and Renee, and it could actually happen. So let's work towards that, guys.
I'm still trying to remember what we gave the ship name for Dinah and Diggle, and I still can't remember.
Wasn't it? Did we give it a name? Okay, Dinah.
We did.
John. No, Gina would be horrible. I was definitely not that. Driggle? Draggle. It was Draggle.
Yes, it was Draggle.
Okay. Anyway, we veered off track. I love the town hall scene where we finally got some citizen response regarding the vigilantes, right? So now we have proof in canon that the people want the vigilantes back, right? It's like the institutions that don't, but the people do. And I also love, I liked all of their scenes, except for the arrest. But I thought that Juliana, in the scenes following Zoe's rescue, did a great job of balancing, like, Dinah's personal emotions and personal investment in Renee and in Zoe with her professional investment protecting SCP's reputation. So I thought that they did a good job of writing that for her. Also, when Renee's talking to Zoe and he's like, no, I don't have to go out there. I'm staying here with you because I'm your dad. Also, your aunt Dinah doesn't want me to. I love that. Renee stays having the best lines. I love him so much this season. And, of course, Renee and Dinah to me up in the end. I love Zoe's parents. And I love grown-ass Zoe. And I was so glad she told us that Renee is alive in the future. So, yay! All these things. Yay. Okay. The psychiatrist guy? Dr. Parker, or whatever his name was. I can't remember what his name is. Parker. Creepy. Yeah. He was, like, very creepy. He was intriguing. I was, like, I felt like it just seems super random. So I was, like, is this part of some larger plot? So then I was just, like, you know, waiting. I was waiting for, like, the other shoe to drop, but...
And then it never dropped.
Right, it never dropped. We'll get into that later. But within the, like, dream sequences, visions, whatever, I really loved the scene of Oliver and William, right, where he imagined what he would tell William. I thought that was a really moving moment. I thought that Stephen did a great job in that scene. So, yeah, it gave me the feels, even though I did not understand why this was happening. Okay. Laurel doing her lawyering for Quentin. Every day I cry about Quentin Lance. Quentin Lance, do you mean so much to me? I was super into their team up. I really liked that we got a little bit more of a glimpse into Earth 2, thanks to Laurel's, you know, speech about her having lost her father and her Oliver because they were murdered. And she even talked about Felicity being a hard ass on Earth 2, right? So we got a little bit more of all of them, which I liked. And I love that it was Laurel who was talking sense to Felicity and that she was coming more of a place from, like, what you're doing is not logical and is not going to have the best outcome. Even though there was also the emotional component of, like, the further you get into the dark, the harder it is to climb back. And I would know, because right now I'm just trying to stave off even more dark. That was really cool. I thought that it was, like, some of the best insight we've gotten into Laurel, at least this season, but, you know, since Quentin's death. So, what did we not like about this episode?
I'm not sure I like where this story is going regarding the Glades. When Dinah in the future said that Star City fell when the Glades rose and all talk of a wall, I raised my eyebrows so high. Like, what are the Arrow writers trying to say? That the destruction of a city will come when the poor and underprivileged communities finally gain some power and footing in the city? So I don't know. On a show like Arrow where Oliver was supposed to be fighting for the people who live in the Glades, it doesn't look good that they're putting some of the blame on that same area for the devastation to the, like, richer, nicer part of the city. And I think it looks bad when even William didn't know what Felicity's office looked like, meaning he never stepped foot inside her company building. And so the flash forwards were better, but I still find myself being impatient with them, like, where they're leading. And then Oliver saying that William is the most important person to him, knowing what will happen in the future, made me laugh a little bit because they just left him. So I'm like, okay, Oliver, he's the most important person to you. excuse me. The prison scenes were much better in this episode, but the torture was a bit too prolonged for me, and it reminded me of when Prometheus was trying to break Oliver down, except those scenes were much more effective back in season 5. And I thought Dinah was going a bit too hard on the no vigilante thing, and arresting Renee was like a step in the extreme direction, even if it was to prove a point. And finally, I do agree with Tasha about Diggle's talk with Dinah. He was giving her hope. He was giving Dinah hope, but he didn't do the same with Felicity. I don't think that was fair of him. But it's not a particular dislike, more of an observation in how he treats both women, as I feel like he honestly feels closer to Dinah, given that they shared secrets last season. And I guess finally, I did dislike that Felicity was torturing Silencer in the beginning. I know she's finally getting her own story, and I'm interested to see where it's going, but she's already pushing buttons and stepping into territory she can't turn back from once she's crossed that line. And I guess I don't like the fact that she's so willing to cross that line without truly doubting if what she's doing is the right thing. So like I said in last week's podcast, taking down Diaz alone isn't going to get Oliver out of jail. So what are the consequences to her later on?
Yeah. Like, I understand, you know, the methods to the madness, but I don't really like the madness just because I don't understand what the writers are doing with this whole, let's see how dark we can make our characters. And the fact that Felicity isn't really stopping to think about those moralities and the lines that she's crossing, and it's kind of like, you know, I want to do this, but should I do this? Like, she's not having that kind of, like, reflection of, like, how far that she wants to go. And again, like, if Black Siren seems like the same person in your group, then maybe you should, like, take a step back and reevaluate your life choices here. And then, like, I also, like, fuck the Longbow Hunters 1 and 2 that just did not give a shit that their friend is... you know, being tortured. I guess I meant to say that. I don't know if I said that in the last episode where, you know, they're like, Honor's captured, and Diaz is like, well, she's fine. And it's like, you know, yeah, even if I'm still fine, I still want my fucking friends to come and do something, you know? And I feel like it kind of also goes to the whole thing of Black women being strong and vulnerable, and that kind of, you know, myth that we can't be broken no matter how much torture that you inflict on us, and it's just not true. And so I think that also kind of tainted the scenes of Silencer being imprisoned for me on both sides, with her Longbow Hunters not really making an appearance in this episode looking to find her, and then also with Felicity's, you know, decisions on how far can I torture this woman to get what I want, even if like Silencer told her, then what is she gonna do with it? Because like you said, like, just taking down Diaz alone isn't gonna get Oliver out of jail, because Oliver actually did stuff that he should have gone to jail for. So I don't really like that. I also agree that, you know, the whole future plot with the Glaives, I'm not really sure what that means for the plot in the present. Because it just seems like the plot they have in the present now is just, I guess, going to fail because the Glaives rise in the future. I mean, but I don't really understand why that's a bad thing that the Glaives rose. I mean, you know, in the future, I don't like that Zoe and Renee seem to be on the outs with her being a vigilante and, like, the resistance to save Star City and Renee being, like, in the Glaives, not wanting to leave the Glaives. And just like, aside from the fact that Star City is destroying the future, I don't get why the Glaives being, you know, the new Star City is a bad thing. Like, shouldn't the rise of an underprivileged community into a functioning and flourishing city be like a good thing? Like, why do we hate the Glaives? Like, Glaives is where all the good people are. All, you know, what Tati mentioned about, like, what do you call it? Community town hall meeting.
Oh yes,
they had, yeah. And you see all the people. You see how they're affected by bad stuff happening in the Glaives and SCPD not doing anything to help them. And so in the future, they're, you know, they rose, they persisted, they survived, and now they're the bad guys. And it's like, how? How did that happen? I guess, like, you know, if it rose because it became like a crime mecca or something, maybe. But in that case, then what happened to Renee? That he is on the Glaive side over Star City. So I there's something there that just doesn't really connect or make sense. I agree with Tasha that I don't understand the point of let's break Oliver 3.0. Like you said, May, I feel like they already did this most effectively with Prometheus, so I don't really see what there is new to be gained from Parker rehashing the same storyline. I also don't understand why the mystery arrow plot is still such a mystery. I feel like they definitely should have moved that plot forward in this episode. apparently, not apparently, but especially because, like, Mystery Arrow gets hurt falling from that pipe to, like, let the water out, and Renee helps Mystery Arrow escape, and then you have this, like, random-ass cut to Dinah going to Renee's apartment, and Mystery Arrow is just, like, suddenly gone. Like, there was no kind of, did Renee not, you know, care to ask Mystery Arrow who he was, or where did Mystery Arrow go? Was he just, like, referring him from the police now? So, I know you're injured, but I'm just gonna leave you here, and you'll be alright. You know, did he leave, like, a forwarding address? Like, where did you take him? Like, is he not even gone? Like, is Renee pretending that he got away and he's actually, like, hiding in the apartment? Like, I need something. Like, I feel like the mystery is just, like, dragging on too long, and I don't know why they're dragging it out the way that they are and just not moving it forward at all.
When the episode started and Oliver immediately told Dr. Parker why he was on level 2, that he was looking for the demon so that he could, like, stop Diaz. I was like, what is happening right now? Like, is this a part of his plan? Like, does he have some plot where he, like, gives away his information as a way to do something? Because, like, I can't imagine him thinking, yes, this random doctor man seems trustworthy and is definitely not on Diaz's payroll, even though 60% of Star City thus far has been on Diaz's payroll. And then B, like, even if he was just a random innocent doctor, like, I would like to find and torture this man for information on this villain so that I can go get vengeance on him when I get outside of jail, is not a way that's going to succeed. So I don't know why that happened. It was very strange to me. Was he already drugged to say that? I don't know. I just didn't like, it just set me off for the rest of that storyline. Because I was like, why is Oliver being so dumb? And then, of course, like, what you guys already said, that, like, this has already happened to Oliver before. It has already happened in better ways. I liked the William scene, but that was, like, the scene that I liked. Everything else, yeah. I was just like, why are we here? I don't get it. Anyway, this is a little bit silly, but, like, I didn't know why we needed new Green Arrow saving Zoe. I don't feel like it added really to the plot, other than to have, like, the Renee and Dinah scene be more intense. Because, like, Renee was already on the side of the new Green Arrow and would have helped him even if Zoe hadn't been saved. And Dinah was already against him, and the fact that Zoe being saved didn't soften her made her look kind of like a hard ass, you know? Like, I don't know. And then she arrested Renee, and I was like, I feel like all of this could have happened even without Zoe being saved. So I don't know. I just thought it was weird. I thought it would have led to something for her, but, like, it wasn't even like it sparked her interest in being Black Canary initially. Those just unrelated things. I don't know. Okay. So that doesn't matter that much, but I was, again, questioning.
Or it would have made more sense if that kind of led to, you know, Green Arrow revealing himself to Renee, but that didn't happen. Right. So.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it didn't go anywhere. It was just like, oh, okay, well, I just had a thought for where this was going to go, and then it just didn't go there. And I was like, why? Why was this here? Okay. And as much as I liked Laurel talking Felicity down, I did not like that she had to. Like, I feel like it's been such a huge flip for Felicity. Like, she's prepared to, like, torture, maybe even kill Silencer. Like, Laurel had to be like, if you kill her, you won't get information. And Felicity's like, well, I'm not getting information now. And I was like, is that the only... is that the only reason to kill or not kill someone? I guess. And so, yeah, I don't know. I get what they're going for, that, like, it's hard. This has hardened her. But I don't know that we've seen enough of that journey to really buy how hard she is right now. I also do not buy, and do not know why they even want me to buy, that Felicity is dead in the future. I don't think it's going to stick. I don't think it makes any sense. I feel like it was just kind of there for shock value, but whatever. So I will kick off our predictions by saying, she's definitely not dead. And we'll go. What else do you guys predict?
Like, the whole Parker scenes with him and Oliver, and the fact that Oliver was dumb enough to tell him the real reason why he was in level 2 in the first place. I'm like, is Parker the demon? Did, like, Oliver just reveal himself to the man that he was supposed to find, and now he won't find them because the man already knows?
I think Parker was the demon.
Yeah, that's a good prediction. I got nothing, but I'm going to piggyback on that.
It's like Pasha, that Oliver's just, like, faking it till he makes it, and that he's not reformed or whatever after that session.
Yeah. I agree with this prediction, And I also think that that dude named Hackett, who has never mattered before now, must have some connection.
That's what I said. Yes!
The car kept being like, your dad's a murderer. He killed this guy named Hackett. What about Hackett, Oliver? And I was like, has anyone ever cared about Hackett?
No one probably remembers this poor man's name until today. I was like, Hackett? I don't even remember him being on the boat.
I remember him being on the boat, but like, I don't, there's something fishy there, okay? So that's another prediction.
Thank you for validating my stupid theory.
As for the living situation, what I'm thinking is, like, because Dinah mentions that someone's been buying a property in the trades, in the glades, sorry. So I think that it's, like, trading one set of, like, poverty and you know, and crime and whatever for another. So it's like, I don't think that the people of the glades probably benefited from what happened there. I feel like it's, like, someone, like, gentrification type of situation, right? Except, like, super evil instead of just basic evil. And then, like, maybe the people from the glades were, like, kicked out, like, sent to Star City. I don't know, you know? There's been, like, a trade, and that's why there's a wall to keep those people from going in. Because isn't Dinah also in the glades? Like, she got there through the tunnels.
Yeah, but it doesn't really... why would Renee want to set foot in Star City?
Maybe, yeah, but he might not be in the plates, he might be somewhere else, I don't know. But yeah, so it might be because of death there, because of whatever thing happened that Roy is also mad about, I don't know. You know, but we'll see. I don't know, like, if I didn't think that that's what they were going with, I would also be mad about what you guys are saying, like, that, like, well, the poor people got money, and then, you know, and made better life for themselves, and now you're blaming them. But I don't think it was them that did that. Mm-hmm. Or I don't think that they're being benefited. I hope that is clearer in the future,
What
they're doing with it.
I also think for the flash forwards, there's a lot of mystery there, but everyone's overlooking the Roy mystery because he doesn't want to talk about his past. So, like, what happened? So, hopefully that'll... It's not a prediction, but, you know, it'll be revealed.
I agree. All right. So next up, it's we're done with predictions. So now we're gonna do ladies, right? Who are ladies with gumption nominations? Anyone want to go? We got one for Supergirl, one for Arrow. Hopefully,
I think for Supergirl, I'm gonna nominate Alex. She was going through a lot in this episode, and she struggled with being a leader for the first time. And there was a lot of stress in the situation because people were dying, people were being betraying her and all this other stuff. And I think she handled it. She had some obstacles, but eventually she handled it really well.
I agree. I do think that Alex would be my lady with gumption from all of Side A, because I'm trying to think of which one I would say for Arrow, and I'm not, like...
I don't have one for Arrow.
Like, Dinah definitely... had gumption, but I'm not, like, rewarding it, and same with Felicity, and, I mean, Laurel,
I don't know if it was gumption, but she had a good episode.
Yeah, she had a good episode.
I did, Alex, and, I mean, Lena and Nia also had good scenes, but they didn't have, like, a big part of the episode. It's not really gumption, but she deserves something, so I'm going to put Fiona's name out there because she's
the that's true. Runner-up. Yes. Fiona was held out just so that she could have a scene in person, full-bodied, before she went out.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think she, you know, for surviving being held captive by, like, racist people and torture, I think she deserves an honorable mention, so.
I agree with that. Shall we leave Arrow and head off to Side B?
Yeah.
All right. Side B. Ball Kick Paradox / Mission Critical. Okay. Legends of Tomorrow. Dancing Queen. When the legends discover a fugitive's hiding in 1970s London, they realize he is a part of a gang that is targeting the British monarchy, and that someone from the legends must infiltrate them. But surprising everyone, Ray ends up being the one to gain their trust after being put through a series of tests with the help of Sarah and Rory. Meanwhile, Gary shows Nate the ropes at the Time Bureau, but it turns out to be anything but an ordinary day at the office. Kristen Wendell directed the episode written by James Egan and Morgan Faust. What did we like about this episode?
I did like that Ray finally revealed to Sarah that he was the one that let Nora Dark go, and that his actions then mirrored his actions in this episode with wanting to let Charlie go because he saw the best in her, so I thought that was really nice. And Ray and Charlie bonding and Charlie confiding in Ray was a nice scene, and I like that it introduced the whole not all magical creatures are evil concept, since the Arrowverse tends to be more black and white on matters like this, because Flash still functions on the concept that all metahumans are going to do bad things unless they're on Team Flash. Charlie indicated that humans were also garbage for locking them all away because they were scared, and it kind of parallels Zari's future and our current reality of people, you know, doing unspeakable and horrible things because of fear, not being able to understand others. And I like that Zari didn't push Ray to tell everyone else about letting Nora go, but that she was also proud of him for doing it on his own. And I love the opening scene of the, you know, quote-unquote queen going to perform on stage and then finding out that she mooned everyone. That was really funny. And I like the scene of Ray's blubbering attempt at kidnapping the queen's dogs. And finally, I thought it was very sweet of Zari to give the picture of Constantine and his mom laughing at the bar to him. And I think she knows he's going through an obviously tough time, but she doesn't push him to talk about it and gives him a space while also making sure he knows she's there if he needs to talk. So I love that Zari is getting these nice heartfelt moments with all the characters and that she's kind of become the glue that's holding them all and their secrets together.
I really love her this season and how, like, last season I feel like it was more Maya was at that heart that was kind of the glue holding all the characters together. And this time it's Zari, and she's got, like, a little bit, you know, Maya is very, like, sweet, and Zari is a little bit spicy, I guess. I was going to say sour. But like,
yeah,
like,
yeah, I was going to say sour, too.
Yeah, but she's got kind of, like, a little tang to her that it's, I like it, is what I'm trying to say. Because, you know, with Ray, she's very supportive of Ray and understanding of, you know, the reasons why he felt like he had to rebel, and I think she was a little bit, like, part of the reason she was proud of him, she's like, oh, my little rebel, you're growing up, and then the whole, her situation with Constantine, she made Constantine, his grumpiness seem more bearable and understanding this episode, and I like that she, you know, she found a way to at least give him a piece of the life that he never had with the picture of his mom, which I thought was really sweet. Ray being the sweetest being ever and trying his best to, like, rage against the machine was really humorous because he's just, like, the squarest of square and never, you know, broken a rule in his life kind of person. And so I thought it was really apropos that he was the one that infiltrated the gang of punks and had to blend in with them. I feel like him having to pretend to hate Disco probably damaged him in his soul. And pretend like that, you know, I don't like Disco, I don't like, he's more of like a Beatles guy instead of like a punk rock guy. So like his like clean cut image versus the Smell, which is like the dumbest name for a band ever. But anyway, I thought that was, that dynamic was really funny. I also thought it was cute that Mick and Sarah worked behind the scenes to help Ray steal a Corgi and up his street cred because they that he had done. He was not going to be able to get that done on his own. So I liked that they were supporting him in that. And I liked that he actually got to know Charlie and that they had, like, really, really good conversation where she was talking about small-minded people got scared and that's why Charlie was locked away. And it kind of reminded me a lot of the Witch Hunt episode. And the fact, Charlie is a shapeshifter, and so that means Charlie's gender fluid. We don't really know who or what Charlie is, so, but since Charlie was female for most of this episode, I'll just use female pronouns, but, you know, just to get that out of the way. So I really enjoyed Charlie, the character, but there are other things about the way that the episode played out that I didn't like. That I'll get into later. I also like the whole bad things for good reasons because I think it paralleled Zari and Rey's discussion earlier about Rey letting Nora go with Rey and Charlie. And Charlie, I think Charlie's the one that said it in that time, that bad things were done for good reasons. And so I think that that was a nice parallel for Rey in the beginning and the middle to end of the episode. I like that Charlie defended Rey once the band found out that Rey used to be in a disco group. And I think that's when Charlie said it, too. So I like that because it shows that Charlie's not a bad person. Charlie's just kind of a trickster. So I like, you know, like May, that it shows that, you know, not all magical creatures are default evil creatures. And even after Charlie knocked Rey out because Charlie was scared that they were going to get sent back to hell, I like that Rey still defended Charlie and the other legends to see that what they were doing was not necessarily a good thing in this instance, which I feel like they would have known if they had listened to Rey or gotten to know Charlie, but stories for other parts of the episode. And then Nate and Gary's plot, it felt a little campy, but at least it moved the plot forward a little bit and learned the real reason why Nate doesn't want to go back into the Wave Rider, because I didn't understand that either, why he wouldn't go back. So it was good to learn that he is still kind of dealing with his feelings for Amaya.
I accept this. I thought that the opening sequence was hysterical. I love, like, when I saw that it really was the Queen, I was just sitting there, like, imagining, like, what is Queen Elizabeth thinking about this if she watched this episode? I would be like, what? This is a terrible depiction of me. Please bring the crown back. If more time had been devoted to the Smell's vendetta against the British monarchy, they could have made a really interesting social commentary on colonialism. But, like, as it was cool to see just, like, you know, like, sort of like the punk rock perspective of what is wrong with England, right? And then, like, the bad thing that they're trying to prevent is the fall of the British monarchy, but, like, is that really bad? Right? So, it's interesting, you know, interesting to think about, even though the episode was not actually about that. I really like the first actress who played Charlie. Anjali Mahindra is her name. And I love the bond that Charlie formed with Rey. I think that it was really nice to see his tendency to believe the best in people reflected in his dynamic with Charlie, especially once she, and I will, like Jessica, I will use the she, shared her shape-shifting story with him. And I like that his faith in her, you know, then allowed her to trust him and, like, pay it forward, right? Like, she then had faith in him, even though he lied, like, 300 times. And she then could use the information that she obtained to convince the rest of the legends of her right to live. The fact that she had to do that will be in my dislikes, but I would happily have watched a spinoff miniseries of Rage and his journey to punk rock, especially if it included his lost disco days prior to discovering a new music form. Alas, it was not to be. I really loved the stealing of the Corgis, and that was a perfect, like, blending of Rey's, like, naive cluelessness but, like, charming nature with, like, Sarah and Nick's expertise, right? Like, that's one of those hijinks montages, if you will, that Legends does really well.
Yeah.
And then I like that Rey got to flip things on their head, because, like, everyone thinks that Rey is kind of just, like, a bumbling ray of sunshine, and he was like, hey, you know what? I'm so full of sunshine that I helped Nora escape the bureaus that she, too, can find sunshine. That you didn't expect that, bitches. And they did not expect that, so that was really great. Zari, like y'all said, she's the new heart of the Wave Rider, the new almost moral compass, if you will. But I loved her bonding with Constantine, and, like, her empathy for him as he was, like, pining for his mother was really sweet, and it was really sad to see Constantine in that state. I love that she brought him that photo of him and his mother, and I even enjoyed his attempt to give his father a vasectomy, like, because it was, like, in the moment, it was funny, but there's also, like, those layers beneath it, right? That, like, Constantine is, like, so down right now that he wouldn't even care if he didn't exist anymore. He wouldn't care if he died, basically. So it was really sad, but well done. And finally, the Gary and Mona interaction was very weirdly cute. Like, I don't know what I was supposed to make of it, but I enjoyed their, like, two scenes together. And I found his investment in making Nate like the Bureau work very cute and endearing. Because Gary is a very endearing person. Okay, what do we not like?
Well, I think what can be said first and foremost is, like, you had really two impressive episodes with Legends this season, and this one is just not the best. It didn't have the same kind of energy. I mean, you know, it, like, I guess you can't have tens all the time, so they were due for a downturn, and I guess this is it. like, I'm trying to figure it out. Like, I don't know, like, was it because it was Ray-centric, and Ray's kind of like a, you know, goody-goody character, and so that's why stuff fell off, but then it's like, you know, the 1980s episode they did, and I can't remember if it was season 2 or season 3, but when they went to Baby Ray's past, that was Ray-centric, and I love that one, so it can't be Ray. So I'm not really sure what it is, but it just felt kind of boring to me. It was just kind of there. It's not like a strong dislike or whatever. It's just kind of like a, you know, meh type thing. Mm-hmm. And then I know, like, Shane likes the way that Maisie's character was introduced, but I'm just a little bit put off about the explanation behind the character and how, you know, how Charlie has a Maya's face, but it's completely different because Charlie is a shapeshifter, and specifically because John trapped her in that form. I like Charlie's introduction, but we as the audience already know Charlie will eventually be played by Maisie, so it's kind of underwhelming that that Charlie stays in one form throughout most of the episode, because, like, the whole time I'm waiting, like, okay, where's Maisie? Change! Change! Let me see Maisie! And to figure out how that fit in. So I was kind of, like, put off by the way they did it, because I felt like, because we don't know Charlie's real form, and you're not going to be able to see that now that John has trapped Charlie into Maya's body, we got so connected to Anjali as Charlie that now Maisie as Charlie is just like, this seems fake, but okay. So I don't know, it's kind of a disconnect that we don't get to see who Charlie is, and then also Charlie is stuck this way because of choices that John made and took that power away from Charlie. I didn't really like that at all. I don't like that he permanently, in his explanation for, like, can you undo what you did, is like, no, once you, like, clip it, you can't really unclip it. And I was like, well, then why did you clip it in the first place? And, you know, having John do that after Charlie confided in Ray about being mistreated and misunderstood as a shapeshifter and not being believed, it just felt like another slap in the face for the character, who is mischievous but not evil. Like, Charlie didn't deserve to have her powers, like, taken away from her. It's Charlie's body, Charlie's choice, damn it. And I don't like that, you know, it's not John's choice. I don't like that John made the decision, not even with Legends. Like, Legends collectively didn't come to that decision. John made that decision because John was tired and waiting on everybody else. And then on top of that, not only does Charlie no longer have powers, Charlie's still a prisoner on the Legends ship. So they didn't say, well, we're not going to send you to hell, but you can go wherever. Charlie's still stuck, so Charlie's like in a prison within a prison, because Charlie's also in a body that's not Charlie's. So it's just, you know, injustice upon injustice kind of thing. The whole Mick and Constantine pretending to have like a pissing contest of who can be like the worst TM is getting a little bit old. I kind of felt bad for Zoe initially having to have the babysitting storyline. It turned out endearing and nice at the end, but yeah, like, especially the whole, like, rivalry between Mick and Constantine is just like, let's get over it. You're both ugly, so let's move on. And then the whole Nate bored at work, Nate is so bored at work that he wants to be time bros with Gary, and it's just like, well, why did you leave the Wave Rider to do this and still be bored and want to do the same thing that you could have been doing with Ray on the ship when he asked you to go on the ship with him? Like, Ray was right there last week giving you sad puppy dog eyes and you said no, and now you're stuck at work on Taco Monday.
Ray's constantly rejected.
And it's your fault, Nate. It's your fault.
All of that. I mean, I definitely agree about Maisie as Charlie and how that whole thing played out. And I legit thought it would just be a character who just happened to look like her, like a doppelganger or something. But the way they decided to use her face just felt kind of wrong. Constantine trapping her in that form was a bad way to go about it because, one, it's hurtful to the rest of the team to have to look at her with the face of a friend and no one thought to tell Constantine otherwise. And two, they're taking away Charlie's choice in the matter, like you said, Jess. So what if she wanted to keep that face just to continue to piss off Legends because I could see her being that angry at what they were trying to do to her? But that wasn't her decision to make. And plus, they didn't listen to Rey at all and essentially trapped someone who wasn't using her powers for evil and then went in to grab her like a bunch of crazed, bloodthirsty people. They were looking at the situation in black and white with no gray areas and kind of became the ones making the bad choices instead of the heroes on this occasion. And I think they could have allowed Charlie some space, explained to her why her mischief essentially fucked up the timeline, and convinced her to join them somehow. So Charlie joining the Legend like this is a really bad start. Constantine acknowledging his racism and continuing to believe that the magical creature had to be the Irish guy was a bit jarring because it was played for laughs, but especially since it turned out not to be the Irish guy at all. So the punk band were all not who they said they were. So you'd think the Legends would understand a bit where they're coming from and trying to pave a new path for themselves and leaving behind their past lives. But we didn't really get much of that. And finally, I found that I didn't very much care for Nate and Gary's subplot. And besides the introduction of Mona, formerly Alaska, and makes me wonder why they changed her name. And that interaction between her and Gary was really cute. But I think the subplot was fine for what it was, but it was a bit jarring since this is only the first time we're hearing Nate even mention Amaya this season. So that kind of felt, not that it came out of nowhere completely, but it would have been nice had, like, the previous episodes had him kind of, like, having longing looks at something that was Amaya's or something like that. So that finally when we got to this point, I would be like, okay, that makes sense.
That is a good point. Until Gary brought up the fact that he was dumped by Amaya, I thought just Nate, you know, just forgot.
Exactly. I was like, oh, he's only here for his dad. That's the reason.
No, yeah, I mean, that's how I felt, too. Like, I was like, oh, I guess he's here for his dad. It didn't seem to me like he was actually there because of Amaya. There was no one was really talking about Amaya before that moment. Like, I think that even Wally got more of, like, a one-line send-off than Amaya did, which makes sense in the sense that we actually saw Amaya depart. But if she's left such a gaping hole, you'd think that it would have been brought up in previous episodes. So, but again, like, I'm being a little hypocritical because the way that Ray explained it to Charlie, I was like, yeah, that totally makes sense. You know, that felt really natural. But Gary bringing it up to Nate felt really unnatural to me, and I didn't like it. Perhaps because Ray and Amaya did not have, like, a particularly deep connection, so it makes sense that he would just bring that up as, like, a general thing that happened to them. But Nate just went through, like, a huge breakup, right? That then for him to show no signs of it until Gary was like, oh yeah, my breakup with Constantine and your breakup with Amaya are exactly the same. Like, what? Okay, I guess. So yeah, I agree that most of their subplot was boring to me. I liked the phrase time bros, but I did not need the minutes spent on the, I don't even remember what creature it was. Whatever, the creature that then ended up being the plant. Like, oh, that creature disappeared and now it's a plant. And I was like, are those two things actually connected? Like, did that creature become the plant? Does it matter? I don't care. So I've stopped asking. But I didn't need it. And I don't know. I can't tell if it's like an excuse to keep Nate off the Wave Rider because they don't want him to meet Charlie. Or if I am really supposed to believe that all along they really wanted to show that Nate was just coming with excuses because of Maya. But if it's the latter, then they didn't do a good job for me. And if it's the former, then why? Why wouldn't you just let him meet fake Amaya? I don't know. Okay. Now, this is a nitpick, but I don't like that Gary is only a guest star, but he's gotten more story than Ava so far this season. So, like, either they're not paying Adam enough, or they're not using Jess enough. But, like, one of these two things should change. Now, on to the important stuff. Given how much I liked Anjali's performance as Charlie, I felt like it was a huge disservice to Maisie to have the character in one form so long before bringing on the Amaya form. And also a disservice to the actress playing Charlie, right? Because it's like Jess said, while that girl is Charlie, you're waiting for Amaya. You're like, where's Maisie? Where's Maisie? And then once it is Maisie, it feels wrong because it's like, we don't, obviously that previous version of Charlie wasn't her true form, but it was the form that was chosen, right? That was the form that she wanted to be in. And then without any choice, she was turned into the Amaya form. So it feels wrong, like, in-universe, because it feels like Constantine has taken away her choice, and has taken away, like, her agency and literally changed her body forever. But out of universe, it feels wrong because it feels like that's not who Maisie's supposed to be playing. Like, I thought Charlie would just, originally I thought Charlie would be like a different Earth's dimensions version of Amaya, or her name is Charlie, you know? But now it's like they literally just traded in one character for another and just kept Maisie around. Like, it's like a, even a step further than what they did with Rip. So I don't know. It's like a weird, like, characters are disposable thing that I still don't like about Legends. I also, it didn't sit right with me. Like, the way that people, like, especially Constantine was treating her like she was, like, an animal or, you know, less than an animal. But everyone was kind of being an unfeeling asshole other than Rey. Because it's like, yes, the first creature that you met was a serial-killing unicorn. So you had to send it to hell. And the second creature was a serial-killing fairy godmother. Okay, you sent her to hell. That's fine. But, like, now you meet this shape-shifting punk rocker who mooned the audience while pretending to be the queen, right? And, like, that everyone agreed. Like, there was no dissension in the ranks. Like, yeah, let's send her to hell, too. Why? Why would you send that person to hell? Like, you have no idea what they're capable of. And then Constantine just comes in being like, oh, well, shapeshifters are, like, the worst of the worst. So, okay. Like, I maybe if he says that, because of whatever reason he feels that way, I could buy that. But everyone just being like, yeah, that makes sense. Constantine, who previously told us that the evil person was a leprechaun because he's, you know, racist against the Irish.
And it's funny because there are people on the Legends team who have done worse than what Charlie's done.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I felt like everyone just, like, lost their brains for, like, the duration of that plot. And then Charlie turned into Amaya, and suddenly they regained their brains. So I was like, okay, whatever. I didn't like that at all. And then she was still punished, right? For daring to be Amaya? And then John, like, took away her shapeshifting powers? But, like, John doesn't even know Amaya, so why does John care? Because he hates the shapeshifters? Like, should I have watched Constantine to know why he hates shapeshifters? Is it just, like, the Irish? I don't know. But anyway, all of that was bad. So that soured the episode for me. Okay. Do we have any predictions?
No.
No, yeah.
I have a minor prediction, which is just, as previously mentioned, you know, Mona, who was very cute, was originally named Alaska, or at least in, like, the promotional materials, her name was going to be Alaska. So I'm going to assume that Mona is an assumed, I'm going to say Mona is an assumed identity. And that she was just trying to sneak her way into the Time Bureau. Mm-hmm. And, like, maybe she's immune to the memory flasher and it's just, like, a performance, right? Like, he does, like, we can just, I don't know how many times this has happened, like, because it seems like Gary has, like, a rapport with her, right? That she shouldn't have because the memory flasher. So, I don't know how maybe he's done that several times, or he thinks he's done that several times, but it actually doesn't work. And she just keeps storing it to, like, get information on the Time Bureau. That's my prediction.
I like
it. I would agree. Because I do think that Alaska is her true identity. So I do think that there's something about, because also, like, the way that they introduced her with her being, like, the food guy, you know, seems a little bit, because we know this is, again, something that we know is going to be a new character on the show. It's going to have an important role. So the fact that she introduced as Mona and as, like, the food cart girl is just, kind of seems like a red herring about, you know, when is her true storyline going to start.
Right. I agree. I'm wondering about this, and I'm excited. Okay, so next up is Titans, our final show. The episode was Together. After rescuing Rachel from Dr. Niles Calder, Dick and Corey hit the road with Rachel and Gar. But when the nuclear family again tracks them down, all four decide the time for running is over. Now they work in unison. As they take on the nuclear family, we witness the birth of the team that will come to be known as the Titans. directed by Mira Menon, written by Edward Hill and Gabrielle Stanton. What did we like?
Everything. I feel like this episode should be called, like, Family Feud. Because it's, like, the Titans family versus the nuclear family. I love how the Titans really feel like a family unit, and how they were paralleled with the nuclear family this episode. Dick and Corey are literally mom and dad, and it is the best. They're both, like, so protective over Gar and Rachel. They strategize together, make decisions as a parental unit. Like, it's the best. TheBomb.com. I like that Dick went into full dad mode when he traded in his Porsche for a minivan. I was kind of mad about that Porsche, but, I mean, it was a good practical dad choice to get the minivan so that they all fit comfortably. Because I was wondering, like, how they all fit that. I was wondering how they all fit in that Porsche that looked like a two-seater. And, like, we've got, like, four people in there, so how's that working out? So, minivan. Yay. I also like how he immediately went into leader mode once they got to the motel to get the team into shape and get them to train. But then, like, when it was his turn to perform, he was like, okay, that's over, that's canceled, let's move on to something that really matters. like, he's just so determined and serious, and he's overprotective, and I like how it's balanced out nicely by Corey, because she's kind of like laissez-faire, free spirit, unimpressed. Like, during their first training session, she's just, like, over it already, and I really liked her laugh, like, when Gar transforms back into his human. It's just, like, the cutest thing. Like, she's just so amused by life. I love how she has no idea about the mystery of her own identity, but she is, like, determined to figure out Dick's. I thought that was really funny, how she got, like, the tequila to kind of open him up. And get to the bottom of his issues. I'm also amused that Dick tried to distract her with his dick. it didn't really work out because she still wants him to open up, but I like that he tried. I thought it was really funny when he disappeared from view for a moment because I was like, oh. And then he comes back and is like, I can't get your boots off. I was like, oh. So it was a nice little, like, sexy, but also communicate at the same time. I liked Gar and Rachel together. I think they have an adorable friendship. I liked specifically, like, when he's describing what his power feels like for her to kind of imagine it. And I kind of wonder slash hope if she'll start to learn to control her powers by focusing on, you know, how Gar describes him and how it feels for him. So I just thought it was a nice bonding moment between them. And I also like that Corey and Dick are watching Rachel and Gar, and Corey's all, oh, they look so cute. I'm just going to nudge them together, nudgy, nudge, nudge. And then Dick is all like, wow, I love male and female platonic friendships. Ha! So it's like their differences in how they both react to Rachel and Gar is also kind of just really kind of endearing about how they all kind of fit together. I liked Dick being dad again and taking down Rachel's mirror because the demon in her scared that she saw in the mirror scares her. So I like that, you know, he didn't even ask her why she wanted it down. He just took it down because she wanted it down and it scared her. And I thought that was really sweet. When the nuclear family shows up and mom, aka Corey, couldn't protect the kids because it was nighttime and her powers weren't working. And then Dad showed up in his Robin suit. And I thought that was awesome. Then Gar fanboying over Dick being Robin. Jason at the end showing up. Like, basically, this whole episode was a bunch of likes for me. I really enjoyed this episode.
I did too.
Yay!
I was like, finally, a solid episode of Titans that focused on the four main characters and some of the plot. Sort of. We got some vague answers, but it's some progress. And I really like the training scene as well, and that they each took time to show what they could do. And I like that even though Corey doesn't remember who she is, like you said, she's getting a handle on what she can and can't do with her powers and what charges them. So that was really nice. And Gar being like, I can't change while you're looking, was great because it was like one of those moments where you're just gotten too old to change in front of your parents and you're embarrassed because you're not a baby anymore. And I agree with Jess, this episode really made the four of them feel like a family. And I like that that's how the fight with the nuclear family was split up. So the four of them strike a really good balance and personality where Gar and Corey are the lights to Rachel and Dick's inner darkness. And I think the Dick and Corey sex scene was fiery and full of chemistry. He did try to distract her, and it worked for a while. So, some points. And I continue to like that Corey is not convinced that Dick is okay, and her persistence in trying to get him to let down his guard works for me. Otherwise, Dick is just going to stew in his own shit and be all mopey forever, so someone has to get him to talk. But really, it also feels like setup and a foundation for a relationship outside of just sex, because this is kind of getting them to, like, open up to each other. And I also did laugh when Corey walks into the motel room after the nuclear family's heads exploded, and she's like, shit, Dick's gonna think I did it. Because you know she's right. I'm also glad that Dick finally revealed himself as Robin to the rest of the team, so the cat's out of the bag. And I loved how excited Gar was over the potential to meet Batman, and how Dick was like, he looked like he wanted to roll his eyes. Finally, I like Jason's entrance and how he introduced himself to Dick. In just a minute, he proved to be so much different than him personality-wise. So that relationship already looks like it'll be a lot of fun moving forward. And also, the nuclear family is gone. Rejoice.
Yes, thank God that they're gone. But I totally agree about, you know, the Titans being a family this episode. I really loved how we got to see those different dynamics play out, and everything that Jessica said about Dick being dad of the year was totally on point. And so I just have to, like, give a shout out for Gar, who's just, like, out here putting his life on the line on the daily just because he thought Rachel was cool. Like, he could just be playing video games with the Doom Patrol and not worry about anything other than the chief being rude sometimes. But here he is, ready to die. Because Rachel has nice hair. I don't know. But anyway, I also agree that Gar and Corey are like the sunny side up to Rachel and Dick's dark sides. And it's nice to see those relationships being explored in different ways, right? You have like Gar and Rachel being like babies. But they're like being like really like warm together. And like he easily draws her out and sort of like makes her feel at ease. And then you've got Dick and Corey that are more like the bickering old married couple. But she's investing in his well-being, like, for the sake of, like, the whole team, the whole family, but also because she personally wants to see him come out of that shell, like, and, like, you know, release those demons that are more overpowering than Rachel's, even though hers is literal and his is only metaphorical. But
definitely gave us something today.
Yeah.
Came out of that towel.
Yeah, that's true. I like the training a lot, and I like how it provided a little bit of a glimpse into their personalities. Like, you've got Corey, who's, like, literally clueless about who she is in her entire life, but she's very inquisitive and observant, and that makes it easy for her to get a handle on her powers. And then you've got Gar, who's, like, very impulsive about his actions. He forgets that he's naked after telling everyone that they need to, like, wait for him to cover up. But at the same time, he's very cautious about how his actions affect others, and that's why he hasn't even bitten anyone in those powers. Like, you think that you would maybe lose control when you're a tiger, but he clearly never does. And then you've got Rachel, who's literally afraid of her own shadow, but potentially the most powerful of them all, and the quickest to lose control, because, again, literal demon. And then there's Dick, who just takes withholding to, like, an extreme, right? Like, a whole new level of withholding. And because of that, I liked how much Corey was trying to get Dick to open up, and the sexy times that came out of those attempts were very well done. I like, you know, they had that good sexual tension. They did those, like, loving stares. Good job, everyone. Round of applause. Even though it was kind of just like an appetizer for what we can expect from an eventual romance between them.
Yeah.
It was tasty. So, well done. And also, again, I like that parallel of, you know, Corey's trying to get things out of Dick, and Gar is, like, you know, sharing with Rachel to get her to open up, sort of get her to relax, right? Like, he's able to do that by drawing on his own experience, which Corey cannot do, because she has zero experiences. So, oh well. Finally, I really loved Jason's arrival, and, like, previously I complained that they switched the personalities, right? Jason is Dick, and Dick is Jason, but now that I'm, like, accustomed to this Dick, I'm totally ready for Jason to come in. He's got a great name. I've shared this story many times, but, like, that's literally the reason why I got back into the New 52. Like, I started reading DC Comics again after I quit. I boycotted because of the New 52. But then they had those ads for the Grayson series, the new Grayson series that was coming out, and all the ads were just, like, dick, like, in weird poses or, like, doing spy things and, like, his ass. And then it's just like, you don't know Dick. And I was like, well, I have to read this. So anyway, I cannot wait to see their, like, you know, new brotherly dynamic and to see Dick's reaction to the fact that Daddy Dearest is still keeping tabs on him, clearly. So, what did we not like?
I will say before I get into my dislikes, I forgot to mention, but, because I was just flipping through, like, Gift Sets of the Titans, and just, like, Britain and the scene that he played with Corey when he was, like, taking away the bottle, like, his heart eyes and that little section were just the best. So that was a really, really sensual scene. And then also, I agree with you that I think I've become accustomed to the stick, and that I feel like, and especially will probably be more apparent when we get into the Jason episode next week, his real reasons for why he feels like he has to separate himself from Bruce's Batman shadow, I think are starting to make more sense to me now than they did originally. So I think that, you know, that's good growth for Dick, that it does feel like it's opening up into something that's realistic. Why he has this kind of grudge against Bruce. So that's cool. What I did not like about this episode were minor things, but they were big minor things. But first, and this one isn't a dislike, it's just kind of like a observation, I guess. Like, the whole Sun Woman and Tiger Boy. Like, coming up with code names is not Dick's superpower, apparently. I just thought that was funny. It's not a dislike, but it's just kind of like an observation. And then the thirsty-ass motel lady, like, she wanted a dick distraction, but did not get it. I was like, this is not that kind of establishment, ma'am. Dick didn't ask for all that. Take your, like, broken ice machine and wine elsewhere, please. And I feel like I don't know if that was necessary. Like, why did I need this old woman, like, trying to hop on Dick's dick that didn't really, I don't know what she brought to the episode, and then she died because the nuclear family killed her, so that was also kind of just random. And I feel like it could have been avoided if, I don't see why Dick felt the need to buy 4 rooms for each individual person. He could have, like, booked 2 rooms and had him and Gar in one and Rachel Corey in the other. Just, like, putting them all in 4 separate rooms seems like a really bad strategical choice, because they weren't together when the nuclear family came in, and they could have at least teamed up a little bit better or been more prepared or whatever. But the things that I was talking about earlier, that the minor things that were big, big dislikes. One was the Dr. Adamson and that baby chicken embryo scene was just gross. I think seeing him crack the egg and the baby would have been enough. But then for him to, like, whisk the baby and the prolonged shot on him doing that was gross and unneeded. And I'm actually getting, like, a little bit sick right now just talking about it, because it was just, like, unnecessary. Like, I feel like I need to call PETA right now and, you know, get them to call up and make sure that no animals were actually hurt during the making of that scene. Because it was just unnecessary, and it added nothing to Dr. Adamson's character that I didn't already know. I already knew it was fucked up. I didn't really need to see that. And then the other thing was the darkness of the way the show was shot. The darkness. Like, find the light somewhere. Like, listen to Tyra, find your light. Because the Titans have not been able to do that. And I like the Family Feud motel fight, but I would have liked it more if I could actually see it. I feel like directors have a hard enough time as it is figuring out what kind of lighting to use for black people in regular shows. You know, oftentimes directors get it wrong because they don't know how to light black people. But I couldn't see shit when Corey was fighting the nuclear kids in the hallway. I could not see anything. It's like Titans is dark enough in general with regards to lighting, but just, like, fix it, please. Like, I could not see anything. And I feel like the fight scenes would have looked more impressive if I could actually see them. So those are the two. Hopefully we don't see any more baby chicken embryos again because Adamson is dead. But they really need to fix the lighting on the show. Please and thank you.
Seconded.
Agreed. I thought it was really dumb for Dick to take off on his own, not only without backup, but without any weapons either. So, like, he didn't know what he was walking into. So while his idea was good, the execution wasn't. And that's why Jason had to come and save his ass. And I also didn't like that we had to watch Addison, like you just, mix the chicken embryo and agree that seeing him crack the egg was good enough. So they just prolonged it for no reason. We already know he was shady. We didn't need to see the rest. Finally, the motel lady was probably ecstatic that Dick had a room all to himself, but I thought her flirting with him and going so far as to come up to his room for sex was unnecessary. And then they only seemed to include it so that they could kill her off and indicate to Dick that there was something going on in the hallway. And it just reminded me how they treated Amy for the 30 seconds she was around before she died, like this lady did, and it was unneeded.
Yes. I do agree with that lady. Her, like, hitting on Dick randomly from the start, like, wasn't funny or cute. It was just kind of weird, like, just, like, too much. Like, if it had been a dude doing that to a girl who had come in to check into the hotel, it would have been, you know, outright just awful, you know? So it wasn't any better when it's a girl doing it to a guy. And then, like you guys said, it was just that she could just die and Dick could hear it. Which, speaking of which, the four rooms thing was very unnecessary and dumb. Makes me think that Dick is just not much of a planner. Like, he gave out, like, four or five reasons at the start of the episode why the motel was better than other places, and then none of those reasons actually mattered, because he still got snuck up on anyway, right? It was just like, oh, well, here they are. So you guys should have gone to a nice hotel then. You were just gonna let them sneak up on you. But yeah. And also, I agree that it was kind of dumb of him to go alone to that boss's place, the messenger's place, whatever his name is, because, yes, like, obviously Corey had to stay to protect the children, but, like, don't you have other backup? Like, are Hawk and Dawes better? Like, can they come help you? Like, can you call Alfred to send off one of the Bat family? Like, I don't know. It was kind of strange, because, speaking of Hawk and Dove, like, why did they even appear to begin with if they're not going to reappear? I don't, like, I was just thinking about that this episode. Like, I was like, this would be the perfect time to ask them for help, but you can't, because they don't matter, and we wasted an episode on them, apparently. So, like, it kind of feels like this is, like, a pacing problem with the show. Like, they put that in the front so that you'd have these questions about Dick's, you know, like, what happened to Dick when he was younger? Like, why did he leave Batman? Like, he seemed to have been part of this team. Like, what happened to this team? What was the betrayal? Why are, you know, Hawk and Dove so mad at him? But then they just dropped it for, like, three episodes. So now I, like, almost forgot that I had those questions in the first place. Uh-huh. And we may find them out next week. But will we have needed Hawk and Dove to begin with if the way that we're finding them out is not through Hawk and Dove but through Jason? I don't know. We'll see. Anyway, I also, just the pacing issue was reflected for me in the nuclear family. Like, I've had to deal with their asses for four episodes, and I'm tired of them. And then their Suicide Squad brain bombs explode, and they didn't do anything. All they did, like, Dick got the information for where their boss was from their car, not even from the torture or non-torture where they provided anything. All they did was like, we're after Rachel. Thank you. We knew that. Thank you so much. So, yeah, they were useless till the end. They did nothing for me. I hate them. Like you guys said, the lighting issues. Oh, my God. Why could, like, they have really nice fight choreography when I can see the fight choreography. So, like, why did they not want us to see it? Did they not practice enough? And they're like, let's just dim the lights real low so that no one can tell that this fight is stupid. I don't know. It makes me question. And obviously they're not the only show that does that. There's a lot of shows that love to have the shittiest lighting possible. But it makes no sense. You're getting paid to light the show, aren't you? So, light it. That's all.
Their bills ran so high that they had to turn down the lights.
There you go. That's what it was. Their electricity bill for that episode. Too much. We don't have enough of the budget for more lighting. Okay. Anyway, what do we predict?
I think Jason was probably sent by Alfred, because when he got that call from Dick, he went into worried grandpa mode. He went to Bruce. He's like, your son's asking for money. So he sent the other child.
I think it goes even beyond that. I think Bruce was following from the beginning. Like, he knows, like, his son is, like, in, like, a rebellious teen stage. Like, you go ahead and go out. Like, I don't really understand why Dick was surprised to see Jason or Robin, to be honest, because, like, he's still driving dad's car. that house, that apartment in Detroit is probably owned by Bruce. He called Alfred for money. Like, why are you surprised that Bruce knows where you are and sent Jason to go get you? So I think that Bruce has been keeping tabs on Dick since Dick left. Like, Dick thought he was being independent, and he's totally not.
I totally agree with that. It's definitely like Bruce has got him on lock. You know, he will never escape the shadow of the bat. All right, you better stop trying. But yeah, other than that, I definitely think that we're going to finally get the answers to all the Dick questions that we've been asking all season. We're going to get our sex ed, and hopefully it will be worth it.
You said we're going to get our sex ed?
That's what I heard.
Yes. Because I said we're going to get answers to the Dick questions we had. Get it? Oh. Oh, my God. Jeez.
I'm like, wait, how is that surprising? Wait.
Y'all are useless. Okay. All right, ladies with gumption of side B, let's go.
Oh.
Even though the Flash isn't here, I still think that Iris should be nominated. I'm just kidding. Okay. So, have you got anyone from Legends of Tomorrow? I would say Charlie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I like Charlie a lot, and I think that, you know, she was gonna single-handedly take down the British monarchy and centuries of colonialism and imperialism by mooning some audience members in the shape of the queen.
I mean, I like Charlie's whole, like, philosophy of, you know, the whole, like, bad things for good reasons, and the way that she thought that, you know, bringing down the British monarchy, it was for the greater good, or what she thought was the greater good, and the fact that she, like, stood up for Ray when the rest of the people in her band, you know, decided to dislike him because of his personality or something like that, and I think that spoke to Charlie and being discriminated against for being a shapeshifter. So I like that Charlie stood up for Ray, and then again, Charlie challenged the Legends and got them to finally listen, and understand that what they were doing to Charlie was wrong. So I think that's a good one.
Yeah. I love that, like, even though she's all about, you know, whatever, living free and just, like, mischief and whatever, like, she was protecting Nate, you know? Nate. God, all these white boys. She's protecting Ray. you know? And she wasn't gonna let her friends treat him unfairly, and she gave him several second chances, etc. Whatever. So I think she's cool. I think that she's definitely someone that the others can, like, the others are all rule breakers on their own accord, so they can all follow her philosophy a little bit. Mm-hmm. How about from Titans? Was there a standout lady with gumption?
Well, I think Mom is just Mom, like, all the episodes. Like, Corey, it wasn't, like, Corey's episode, but
yeah,
always, like, you know, strong front and center. But I guess if we're going for, like, one from side A and one from side B, then it'd probably be Charlie.
Yes, I would say the ultimate would probably be Charlie from side B. Mm-hmm. And from side A, would we say that the ultimate was Alex?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. So Alex versus Charlie. Make your case.
It's hard. I feel like Charlie was actually the victim in her story. So her, like, fighting back and overcoming is a slight edge over Alex.
That's true. I think that's true. You're right. Because, like, if, like, Alex showed a steel spine, you know, and she had to fight against the system a little bit. But it was kind of like, it was an extension of what she's already been going through. But I don't know that it was, like, aside from it being really well acted by Kyler and just, like, a good episode for her, it wasn't like she really...
Yeah, because she's, like, the next episode, Colonel Haley's going to be there anyway. So did Alex really win, or did she just, like, survive for this episode?
Because by letting, like, she did flout the president by letting Kara come out, and that's what they needed, and then that she's been punished for that. So, in a way that it's a similar story to Charlie, but the stakes are so much higher for Charlie that, like...
Yeah.
She's fighting against generations and that years of discrimination.
Raging against the machine.
Yeah. Yes.
So, Charlie it is!
Yay, Charlie!
Welcome to Team Charlie! Against your own will, but welcome. Alright. Okay, so, you remember that you can catch us at DCTV Gumption on Twitter, Ladies W Gumption on Tumblr, and ladieswgumption@gmail.com to send us your feedback, leave us nice messages, yell at us, whatever it is that you'd like to do. But also, what you should totally, totally do, and I would love you forever, and I will, like, bake you a pie, and then I will eat that pie because I can't send it to you, is if you go to iTunes and leave us a review. Leave us a rating. Leave us a review. That way, we'll know if you like us, and iTunes will know if you like us, more importantly. And then we might show up on searches. Like, could you imagine that? That would be wild. Let's do that.
The new goal.
I think that's all. The new goal, yes, the new goal. All right. Bye.
Bye. Bye.